From studying economics at the University of Cambridge to working at Goldman Sachs and now investing in innovative African startups, Temi Masella Awoboro has literally followed an advice given to her by a mentor. Welcome to today's episode of Equity Merchants. I'm your host, Jim Gozirim. Our guest for today is Temi Masella Awoboro, a general partner at Magic Fund. She joins me to discuss a wide range of issues around investing in Africa. We discuss everything from growing up as the daughter of entrepreneurial parents in the UK to leading the creation of one of the largest private hospitals in Africa. Now, let's get into it. Welcome, Temi, to this show. So I was going to your profile earlier to get an idea of who you are and what you do. And you struck me as the kind of person that other parents use as an example for that kids. You know, this child doesn't have two heads. So what was growing up for you? What was it like?
So I grew up, I was born in Nigeria and I was raised in the UK. I grew up to what were relatively young parents. Okay. And they were focused on building their entrepreneurial businesses. And so from a very young age, we were sort of raised to be very independent, which I think is something that has always stayed with me. I also had a lot of desire to make their sacrifices that they were making for their careers make sense by doing the best in school. So I was that child who would ask for extra homework in school, much to the disgust of my siblings. So yes, I always had this sense of wanting to do more, be more, and just make my parents' sacrifices worth it. And so, growing up was exciting, filled with opportunities, filled with different experiences.
Okay, that's interesting. I just can't imagine what your classmates felt like knowing that you were asking for more assignments. They probably ganged up once or twice to like beat you up.
Absolutely. More my siblings than my classmates, but it's okay. I live to tell the tale. It made me stronger.
I see. All right. So how did you get to this point? What has your professional career been like?
Yes, so I read economics at Cambridge. When I was sort of thinking about career paths, one of my mentors, the piece of advice he gave me was stay close to the money. So I took that to literally mean that I had to go and work for the Central Bank of England or go to Goldman Sachs. And I decided to go to Goldman Sachs. So I started at Goldman. Actually, first year of university, I did an Easter internship. Okay. And second year of university, I spent my summer with Goldman Sachs. And then sort of after graduating from Cambridge, I joined Goldman Sachs in London. And so I was there for a few years. I was a volatility trader, which was a great place to be trading volatility around the global financial crisis. I joined Goldman at least a couple of weeks before Lehman's went under. So for me, it was, you know, an opportunity to get firsthand view on capitalism, be at the center of capitalism. But there was something missing. For me, I liked the notion of investing, of having a P&L, and being relatively autonomous. But I also wanted to create value, build companies. And just trading and market making, you weren't close to the companies. It really didn't matter. You were just taking short-term views. And so, you know, I decided to go to Stanford, which was not an obvious choice for someone of my background to date. But now when I look back, I realize it was largely due to sort of the entrepreneurial desire and leanings that I had sort of learned and seen from my parents. So I went to the GSB, Stanford Graduate School of Business, 2011, and was there for a couple of years. Coming out, decided to focus my career on buy-side investing, private equity, focused on frontier markets. And so I joined at the time what was the largest private equity fund dedicated to frontier markets, managing about $14 billion. I worked between Dubai, London, and then we had raised a couple of billion-dollar funds, one to focus on sub-Saharan Africa and the other one focusing on healthcare. And they realized that they needed people on the ground to actually deploy the capital. So that was the genesis for me returning to Nigeria in about 2015. Okay. To essentially deploy the capital. So I was investing in growth and buyout transactions on the private equity side, including the likes of fertilizer companies like Indorama, but also out of the healthcare fund. I spent 2 years trying to find a hospital to buy. I couldn't, and so we decided to build with the support of the investors. And over the years, you know, developed that hospital. Eventually, we commissioned the hospital, and it's now the largest private hospital in the country. But while I was doing that, I was also always still passionate about the early stage investing. And so I remained an angel investor. I sort of co-founded an angel investing syndicate in 2017 and also started my journey on the magic side, investing in global venture. So it's always something that has stayed with me, even though formerly I was focused on private equity in my career.
Okay. All right. So what has been your experience investing? So you've done both VC and you've done angel investing. So what has been the experience?
You know, it's a very broad question, but, you know, for me, one of the amazing things, at least investing in the African ecosystem, has seen how that investment landscape has changed. When I started looking at opportunities, early stage investments, first of all, it was mainly local investors that were coming in, especially into the early stage deals, pre-seed and seed. And the quantum of the rounds that were being raised were a lot smaller. You know, now today you're seeing pre-seed and seed rounds that are significantly larger than historically. But you're also seeing more international investors playing in the African ecosystem, which I think is long-term great for the ecosystem. And, you know, in terms of the amount of VC investment that's come into the landscape, I think in 2015 it was about 400 million that was invested into African startups. In 2021, that amount increased to 5.2 billion, yeah, which was three times what African startups raised in 2020. So it shows the sort of maturing of the ecosystem, the increasing appetite for innovation. And, you know, for me, it's been interesting because I see myself not just as a venture capitalist, but more importantly, as an ecosystem builder and an ecosystem stakeholder. And so, you know, it's very important that there's growth, but that it's also sustainable growth and that the companies are really creating value and building businesses that can both scale, but can ultimately be sustainable. So it's been an exciting journey, sort of seeing how things play out. And the beauty of it is, I think we're only just at the beginning. I think there's just so much more value to be unlocked in the ecosystem. Yeah. So I'm excited about what the future holds.
Okay. So going through your website, to summarize your mission statement, it said you believe in the power of private capital to drive change. So what value do you as an investor, what value do you bring to the startups that you invest in?
Yeah, it's a good question. So in my professional career, I've worn different hats, from sort of being a private equity investor, venture capital investor, but also an operator. So most recently I was operating, you know, one of the largest private hospitals in the country. We scaled that from zero employees to over 500 full-time employees. So for me, I have seen firsthand how you take a business from zero to something. And I think that's, you know, extremely important insights for companies that are looking to build, especially at the pre-seed and seed stage. So you'd find that, you know, I tend to sort of be quite hands-on with portfolio companies where they require it or where they want it, from anything from, you know, thinking through product market fit, to thinking through how you build teams, to thinking through how you, you know, position yourself to raise successive rounds of capital, to opening up my global networks to support them in their future capital raises. And this really was the underlying thesis behind the VC fund that I'm a partner with, called Magic Fund. Mm-hmm. It's a global venture capital firm run entirely by founders, and we invest in early stage tech company. And the reason was our thesis is really around founders backing founders. So it's our belief that founders with experience in building companies and operating companies make the best investors, especially at the earliest stage of investing, at the pre-seed and seed stages. And so that's something that we pride ourselves on. A number of the partners in Magic Fund were actually companies that we backed. And post an exit, or even not post an exit, they decided to join as GPs in Magic. And so that's testament to the importance of being able to add value and you know, having the experience of having built and operated companies in supporting the ecosystem and supporting portfolio companies.
Okay. All right, so we'll return to Magic Fund a bit later, but let's look at, you mentioned being an ecosystem builder, so let's look at something around that. So in the past few years, we've had, like, well, let's say scandals, but basically some problems with the way startups are being run. What do you think about startup coaches, for one, and what role do you think investors can play in instituting corporate governance in startups?
Yeah, it's a good point. And this comes back to the point I made around the importance of sustainability of an ecosystem. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it would be a shame to judge an entire ecosystem by the scandals or the misgivings of the startups. That being said, when these things happen, it's important that we as investors, as stakeholders, learn and act, right? Yeah. And so to your point, I think that's the right question. The question is, how do we bolster the governance in these startups, right? Because you're giving a lot of money to very young and oftentimes first-time founders. It takes a lot of experience, but also discipline to scale responsibly. And so I think as investors, you know, we have a mandate to provide the right fiduciary as investors, especially investors that sit on boards. There's an obligation to act responsibility and live up to the fiduciary responsibilities around oversight, making sure that you're actually mentoring that founder around, you know, thinking through governance frameworks, making sure that the company is being and the CEO and the founder are being held accountable to sort of internal those frameworks, and making sure that there's the correct reporting and oversight framework to highlight and escalate things before they get out of control. And there needs to be accountability. There needs to be accountability and ownership taken for where there is, you know, a breach of those trusts and a breach of one's fiduciary responsibility. So I think, you know, the good thing is, you know, in the cases that we have seen, there has been a response. And I think it's been long-term positive for the ecosystem because it sends the right signals to companies coming up that, you know, you have to do things in the right way. And ultimately, you know, the ecosystem is depending on them to act responsibility and in good faith. So I think, it's just taking that responsibility on boards very seriously and making sure that there's the right accountability and governance. Founder coaches help, but I think sort of everyone can be a coach. So through the advisory networks, through the board, where the founder should be leaning on as much as possible, through their informal networks. But that relies on the proactivity of the founder to seek that support. And sometimes you need more formalized ways to enforce upon a founder. Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned building structures, and that's an excellent point, especially in the light of relative inexperience of most of these founders. What happens when you are about to invest in a company and they've not done anything to, like, put in these structures? Do you stop or maybe withhold investing until they put in these structures? Because I don't know how easy it's going to be to ask for these structures to be put in place after you have invested and you're already committed. Mm-hmm. So do you ask for them before or after the investment has been made?
Absolutely. So the first thing I'll say on that is, because of the stage that we've been investing, the vast majority of the thesis actually comes down to making sure you're backing the right founder. And so we spend a lot of time understanding the mindset of the founder and the founding team. We have a preference for repeat founders just because we know that there's a lot that goes into building a company, and, you know, experience matters. So that's the first thing. But I would say, and actually at the stage we're investing, especially pre-seed, you know, often they're not thinking about boards. Boards really only come into play once you sort of raise proper institutional money. Yeah. But what we do advise is, you know, you can have an advisory board, an informal advisory board, early on, and it's good practice. So I wouldn't necessarily not invest, but definitely it always comes up. There needs to be that alignment between us and the founder that there is a desire to implement these frameworks and structures as they progress. There's an alignment as to when and what the right triggers are for them to implement the structures. And then there's also an understanding that there are other more informal structures that they should consider putting in place. Because ultimately, I always advise my companies that you want to build it as if it's a mature company already, right? You want to have your audits in place. You want to do all those things because it makes it less difficult to implement them down the line. So I try and work with them to build with that mindset, which was actually how, when we were building the hospital, that was the mindset we approached. So even though we were a startup with like 10 employees, we were audited by PwC, and, you know, we had all the safeguards which enabled us to grow into the structure. So obviously cost is a consideration. So I'm flexible, but the most important thing is that the founder has the right mindset and the right, you know, is open to aligning in terms of creating those structures over time.
Okay. So obviously the founder is a very big factor in how things get to play out. All right. Okay. So let's dwell on that topic of founders. We have a lot of founders or startups that are like co-founded by more than one person, and often it's not always that the two of them had the idea at the same time. So for a founder who probably had to bring some other people on to help in executing the idea, how would you advise them to go about allocating equity to their co-founders?
Yeah, it's founder dynamics are always interesting. I say, you know, one has to think very carefully about who they bring on as co-founders. It's probably, you know, a more important relationship, or as important than the marriage or the life partnership that you're in. And so definitely founded, and it's one of the top reasons that startups fail, by the way, funnily enough. You know, and so it's very important. And there are different ways you can bring them on as equal partners, because it creates the right level of alignment in terms of driving the business forward. Or you can sort of prorate the equity ownership based on very clear terms or allocation of responsibilities and who's going to be doing the lion's share of the work. There's no, I would say there's no one size fits all construct that works. But the thing that I would say around founder dynamics is transparency is key. So very early on, you need to be having those conversations and transparently. I think where things break down is where there's been a deviation from what was agreed, or certain things weren't even just discussed because you were carried away in the hype and in the excitement of building. And so, you know, my advice is always don't go in blind. Do the work to get to know one another in different scenarios, and their coaches and their, you know, their ways, there's structured ways in which you can do that to uncover your personality types, you know, your working modes, how you complement one another, where your weak spots are. So do the work up front before you get into the partnership, and then be absolutely transparent to then avoid the pitfalls down the line.
All right. Okay, so let's talk about your first investment. You've been investing first as an angel investor for a while. So what was the first startup you invested in, and why did you invest in them?
Oh, That is a tough question. It's been so long. I actually started angel investing when I was still at Goldman Sachs. We created a Goldman syndicate. To make angel investments. So my mind literally cannot go back that far. But I would say the first one that I did here was one of the first ones that I did here was a company called Kukua. Mm-hmm. And they were based between the UK and Nairobi. And they were operating at the intersect of education, entertainment and technology. They had created this STEM character called SEMA that they wanted to use in a different number of ways to promote STEM, especially amongst girls. And so I just fell in love with the founder. She was clearly very passionate about the opportunity. She had packed her bags and moved to Kenya to build the business. And so it was one of the first. It wasn't an obvious investment for us, but mm-hmm. Like I said, founder, just someone that's very passionate, someone that was ready to go the extra mile, someone that had a lot of conviction around the business, and then the opportunity. I'm a mother to two girls, so STEM, the intersect of STEM and gender was important to me, and we invested early before the character was known or before sort of they had gained any real traction. And today, they subsequently launched a YouTube series. I think that YouTube has just greenlit their second series. They're working on merchandise agreements. They're working on a whole host of things. So they've scaled very impressively and been able to raise successive rounds of funding. For me, that was very clear of what the power of early stage investments and that early stage support can do to really scale startups.
Interesting. So let's move away from investing a bit. So you mentioned that you're a mother to two girls. And okay, mm-hmm. Obviously if you're a mother, you're a woman. So what is it like? What is it like as a founder, an operator, an investor? What is it like combining all of that with your job, or well, maybe a job as a parent? How do you balance all of that? Because startups are notoriously difficult to run, and children are notoriously difficult to raise as well. So that's like trouble on all sides. So how do you do it?
It's a good question. And I guess I would throw that back. Would you ask the same question to a man? Out of curiosity.
Okay. Maybe not. So funny enough, I've already spoken to too many men who are like in the same space, but they are not married, or they don't have kids. So mm-hmm. that's like I don't have a okay. very large.
That was a good save. Look, I say that because I find that people often ask that questions to women, but they don't think to ask it to men. Yeah. And it's a function of where we are in society, where women still take on the lion's share of raising the children and being the primary mm-hmm. caregiver. And I think it's something that ultimately has to change. So it brings up a broader question. But I mean, I say that women can have it all, but not at the same time. Mm-hmm. At different points in my life and career, I've had to make prioritization and reprioritizations to make it work. Because you only have the same 24 hours in the day. Yeah. And when you're investing in startups, I say you're their mentor, you're their friend, you're their coach, you're their psychologist. Like, it's a 24/7 round the clock thing. So there's no switching off. And when I was running, when I was building the hospital and working there, it was the same thing. So I say you can have it all, you can't have it all at the same time. At every point in time, I'm very clear on what the priority is. And I try and give it my full attention. So when I'm with my kids, I'm with my kids, and that's it. Nothing else comes into that space. So they feel the full effect of my presence. And when I'm working, I'm working and I'm in the zone. And so I try and be very clear on how I prioritize. And then you can't do it without a support system. So a supportive partner that sees your ambition and supports your ambition. and the infrastructure that comes with that. So I've been blessed to be able to build the support system. I have a supportive partner, and I don't sleep. So you find yourself working around the clock. But you know, for me, the passion that I have for what I do sort of drives me. So, you know, I think you have to be passionate about what you're doing rather than just putting in the hours, because that would then, that helps it also, that helps when you have the passion for what you're doing. So passion, support system, and a lot of coffee.
All right, good answer. So a lot of the success would now be based on like having a very good support system. So founders have to grapple with hiring in their early stages. So whether it's getting co-founders on board or like getting the right team. So what advice will you give a founder who is trying to build the first team for their business?
Yeah, look, I think one thing that I'm always focused on, especially very young, is culture. I think I typically advise founders that, you know, you need to define the culture very early on, because that will help you attract the type of talent and the team that you're trying to build. Yeah. And culture is the thing that carries you throughout the stages of growth, from, you know, early stage to late stage to post IPO. And so a lot of focus on, you know, what is my why? What is the problem I'm trying to solve? And then in that, how do I curate and build a culture that supports what it is that I'm trying to solve for? In building teams, I always say, you know, I definitely do not want to be the smartest person in the room. If I feel like I have all the answers, then there's a problem. So as a leader, your job is to find the people that, or the team that complements you, but also very smart people who you can also learn from. You're setting the vision, you're setting the structure and the strategy, but for the execution, you know, I'm always focused on finding the best people as opposed to finding people who you think you can control and will give you the results and the answers that you want, because it becomes an echo chamber. And I see a lot of companies, when they get to a certain level of scale, you know, if you haven't been disciplined and structured around thinking about how you build the team, especially the most senior management team, you know, making sure that you are putting people there who will challenge you, then it becomes an echo chamber. You start to reinforce your own view of the world, and it gets dangerous, because then, you know, when you're making the wrong decisions, there's no one there to challenge you. So it's always something that I say, have in the back of your mind, you know, be very, very clear on the culture that you're trying to build. Be very clear on sort of what the JDs and KPIs for the roles you're trying to fill out are, and then make sure you're going for the best people you can attract to basically help ensure that not only can they execute to a level that you need them to, but that you have a group of people that will hold you accountable and that can grow with you.
Okay. So the founder is very important in the startup's life, but basically gets the vision, executes it, and all of that, creates strategy, like you just said. But at some point, the business may outgrow the founder, especially if the founder doesn't keep up with the times, for lack of a better word. So when do you think is the right time for a founder to step aside and let someone else? I mean, this is something we've not really done, or we've not seen happen frequently in Africa, because a lot of our companies are still like very young, so we don't have too many founders who have had to step aside. So when do you think is the right time for a founder to step aside and probably hire a CEO to run things?
It's a good question, and I think, like with anything, there's no one size fits all. There's no necessarily right time. It's really subject specific, so business specific. We haven't, like you rightly pointed out, we haven't seen too many in the ecosystem, because our businesses are still relatively young. And so, you know, I expect as companies look to list, that you'll see the profile of the management change, because running a publicly listed company isn't the same as running a private company. There are some founders that will be able to transcend that inflection point, but there are others that may choose to, or that may be required to step aside to bring a more sort of professional manager in. And so I don't think there's necessarily a fixed point in time at which this happens, or in, it has to happen in all cases. So I would say more, you will get a steer from the market, you will get a steer from your customers, but you also get a steer from the board and your investors as to if and when that needs to happen. And my view for founders is, you know, it's very, you should be open to the feedback, you know, because I think it's important to look at a business from a sustainability perspective. So be open to that feedback, be open to the opportunities for growth, and work closely with your investors to know if and when that needs to happen, and to be able to manage that transition to make sure that the business still sort of continues sustainably with or without you, because that's ultimately what the goal should be at a certain level, especially when you're raising third-party capital.
Okay. All right. So let's move to Magic Fund and what you do with at Magic Fund. So you're a partner at Magic Fund. What kind of companies or what kind of startups do you invest in, or does Magic Fund invest in?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, Magic is a global venture capital firm run by founders, and we invest in early stage tech companies. We started investing collectively in about 2017. In 4 years out of Fund One, we backed 70 companies across 5 continents, which resulted in 2 unicorns, 6 acquisitions. And then we subsequently in 2020 decided to go out and raise third-party capital, and have continued to double down on our thesis of founders backing founders. We call ourselves, we are sector agnostic, but we have a keen focus on fintech, health tech, B2B SaaS opportunities, and then, you know, markets, a deep geographical focus on LATAM, Africa, and Southeast Asia. Increasingly, we're also, we've done a number of investments in the Web3, space. And so that's really who we are.
Okay. All right. So you mentioned that one of the areas that you focus on is fintech, and there's this recurring argument in the Nigerian tech space that we have too many fintech startups. What's your opinion?
No. Too many fintech startups. Look, I think the opportunity, it depends how you define that. One criticism, I'll start on the criticism and then I'll end on the positive. Criticism that I do have of the ecosystem is we are seeing a lot of Me Too companies.
Okay.
Right. And so in that sense, you can say, yes, too many. I don't think it's too many in terms of the relative size of the opportunity set, where you still have, you know, 40% of the population that's not financially included. So there's still a massive opportunity set. And so I don't think you can say you have too many fintech opportunities, but there are too many that are going after the same opportunity set. They're not trying to increase the size of the pie. They're going after the same pie and essentially doing the same thing, just hoping that they'll be able to raise as well. And so I think that's something that, you know, over time, the ecosystem will work out. I think we're likely to see over time quite a bit of consolidation in the fintech space, you know, some M&As to essentially reduce the number of players that are essentially going after the same pot. And increasingly, there'll be a desire to see more differentiated value propositions coming into the space. It's been the way because there's been a lot of liquidity. Versus, you know, when I first started looking at the ecosystem, you know, we've discussed the numbers. There's been a lot more capital available. And so founders have been, it's sort of been a founder's market. But I think with everything that's happening in global venture, with everything that's happening in terms of macros, I think we're going to see it more difficult to raise. I think liquidity is not going to be as available as it was. And so founders will really have to think about building companies that are differentiated in order to sort of raise and raise successive rounds of funding.
So I guess we don't exactly have too many fintech startups, just too many chasing the same pie. All right. So finally, what sectors do you think about and you're very excited? Like, especially with Africa, what sectors do you look at and you're like, I want to see what's happening here and I want to see how this goes?
Yeah, I mean, the beauty of the continent is every sector really is ripe for disruption. And so I'm less focused on sector in terms of macro, but sort of value proposition, use case, what is the problem you're trying to fix? Like, I'm really interested to see who is going to come in and disrupt the edtech space. We've had the Andelas of this world, but there's still more to be done in education and in education at scale. So that's very interesting. On the healthcare side, I'm very excited about businesses that are looking to address the ability to pay issue, because it remains the single biggest issue in healthcare, where you still have less than 5% insurance penetration, yet people need to access care. And so there's a scope for technology to provide a solution there. And also, you know, interested in technology solutions that improve the interoperability between healthcare platforms and healthcare systems. There are too many. You've got your EMR, you've got your ERP, you've got your, you know, diagnostics platform, you've got your pharmacy platform. So you've got your payments and payer platform. So finding ways to sort of make sure that the platforms can talk to one another, and the same way APIs have opened financial services, I think there's an opportunity to disrupt the healthcare sector in that space. obviously, fintech, I still remain, despite the too many fintech startups, I still remain super excited by what's going on in this space. You know, especially, you know, for example, you know, there's a proliferation of buy now, pay later companies coming up, but, you know, BNPL when applied to healthcare could be very interesting, right? So it's taking financial fintech and finding new use cases that essentially improve or improve the way that consumers interact with the rest of the world. It's like every company now is a fintech company, right? So embedded finance is a big theme globally, and increasingly will continue to see. And then logistics, mobility and logistics, getting things from point A to point B in an efficient way continues to be important, especially in Africa, where you still have so many frictions and constraints. Super excited by generally most things that are going on. The question is, can we get the right confluence of idea and team to actually then take those ideas to reality, commercialization, scale?
Okay. I don't know if I've said last question, but I think I have another last question. Which will you choose? A big company that is not profitable, and a profitable company that is not exactly big?
Well, I think because of my background, cash is king. For me, I take the profit, because with that you can live to fight another day and scale. I mean, I think there's a lot of big companies that just burn cash, and I don't get it, especially in Africa. You know, that makes sense in markets where you just have such a large liquidity pool that can keep funding you, right? Yeah. But I think in these markets, you have to take a different approach. There's too many frictions and constraints and unknown unknowns that come into play when you're trying to build a business, that I think we can't afford to build without profit insight. And so it takes a different level of discipline and foresight. Otherwise, you just won't survive. You know what it's like. You just won't survive. So that's my bias. adjusted for, and that's not to say I haven't invested in companies that are just burning cash, but yeah, in a different ecosystem, it makes sense. Not in this ecosystem, there needs to be a lot more discipline. Yeah.
All right. So I think that's the last question. So thank you so much for your time. This has been an interesting conversation. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for today's episode. I hope you learned a thing or two from it. I'll appreciate it if you like, share and subscribe to this episode. You can also send your questions and comments to podcast@techpoint.africa. Equity Merchant is a production of TechPoint Africa. You can always find out more about what's happening in the African tech ecosystem on our website, techpoint.africa.